You're listening to a nerdy production.
Warning, this is a nerdy production.
Welcome inside the GM Workshop. This is a weekly podcast about role-playing and game mastering. We will talk to game designers and game masters all over the world, and I hope you will join us in Season 3. This season I want to level up, and I need your help, and therefore I have created a Patreon, and I hope you will join so I can level up the workshop so we can create some new contents for you. Check out the Spiral game I created, and it's called Jungle Teeth. I hope you will check it out and download it for free, and give us feedback and so on, so we can get on to Kickstarter later this year. Welcome to episode 2 in season 3. This should be our episode about our Spiral game with Lars, but we have postponed it 1 week because of technical issues about the website, so we will take our talk with Steve about player agency. So listen in. Roll for initiative! Well, welcome inside the GM Workshop. Today I have been with Steve, and Steve is also on my episode 30 in the season 2. So if you want to listen more about him, you can take a listen in that episode. So, but Steve, just to clarify who you are a game designer or game writer for campaigns Fearful Symmetries and a bunch of other stuff. You have helped on Program Press and so on. So, what you're doing in this time and moment in RPGs, and why should we talk to you about the campaigns and players agency in campaigns?
Well, I've got I'm running three campaigns at the moment. So Fearful Symmetries is one of them. We're up to session 363. we're coming towards the end of our seventh year of play. I'm also running a Vaisen campaign using the England bit, but I think we're going to Scandinavia next. So I've run a couple of sessions of that, and then I'm going to use one of the campaign books.
For sure. I'd like to talk to you more about that, because Vaisen is one of my big pinnacle games in this time. So yeah, and then and the last
one is 13th Age. Now, I wrote some folklore stuff for a folklore bestiary, which is published by the Merry Mushmen, French publishers. And so I used some of that in Vaisen, but I also used some of it in 13th Age.
Mm-hmm.
And the players liked it, so we did another one. And they liked it, so I had to make up something else. And they liked that, so I had to make up something else. Yeah. So that involved a lot of player input in how that was built out from you know, just a one-off game that has turned into four levels of campaign now.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's pretty cool. Let's talk about more about that, because 13th Age is one of my new passions, and I try to leap into that because I always love fantasy. It's where we started, but yeah. I also want to a bit more, not so much crunching the rules and not so much Dungeons & Dragons, but still some player agency, because 13th Age are a lot about creating these, as we talked on with last time we talked to each other. You have this this game with the elves, right? Do you use a fantasy world for it?
I vaguely use the setting that's provided, but I don't particularly use many of the locations. They're there somewhere, but the locations are all my own locations.
Yeah, okay. So you grab some of you can use of the setting and the books. When you look at the if the topic today is play agency into campaigns, roughly outlined, and of course you have run a lot of campaigns in your many years, and so have I, and we will try to talk about how to put players' agency into campaigns, and I've created an outline for us, and how do you put in the good story? Because sometimes I have the experience that the players has want a good story, as you said in the 13th Age campaign, that you have used some folklore stuff. And how do you make sure that your players are on board, and and are into the great story without taking too much agency from them. How do you do this?
Well, I think generally when I'm running stuff, there's a lot of improv. So it's quite reactive to what the players do. I had a background of essentially the folklore was it's a monster book for 5e and OSR. And so it describes a creature and its habitat and has some hooks. And so I asked we were running it with 13th Age. So players or the characters have some, and these are character in the whole world has. So one of them is he's an angel who's inhabiting a human's body. Another one is he's lost his hand was bitten off by a monster and he has an iron hand instead of a normal human hand. And the other thing they have is they don't have skills. Skills aren't defined specifically. You know, there's not a list of skills you pick from. You say what your backgrounds are. So the guy who had his hand bitten off by a monster, one of his backgrounds was I was a fighter in the arena. And somebody else had a background where they were helping the poor in a city. And so I looked at that background about helping the poor in the city. And thought that's a way in to connect him to helping these people with a folklore problem that's going on in this village. And so he'd already chosen part of the story and I just incorporated that into mine. And that gave his character a reason to be there. And the other two, essentially at this stage, they were just, you've hired these people to come along with you. And it's a bit of hard framing, essentially. You just put people straight in the situation. You have been hired by this guy to help with a situation. So, I mean, they can say, we're not going to do that, but that's kind of the end of the game.
Yeah, and that's the meter contract between...
Yeah, exactly.
This is where the story is. It's not...
Yeah.
It's not next door or anything. So yeah, that's and of course the meter contract is one way to make sure the players are into the game and make sure that, but also creating the backstory availabilities in 13H. I like that a lot because you create a lot of tension between the characters and the campaign from these backgrounds and how do you use this for 13H?
Well, so they went and sorted out this folklore problem and then they kind of enjoyed it. And I said, do you want to do another one? And they said, yeah, OK, we'll do that. So I got the background of one of the other players. There was a childhood friend of his that he wanted to go and meet. And there was a problem in her village and it was kind of the same setup. But then after that, you know, we'd run out of the folklore settings. But one of them had a background where he was searching for the head of a mercenary company who had betrayed him. And so I said, okay, we're going to go with that next week. Is that okay with you? And they all said, yeah, okay, we'll go looking for this mercenary company. And so that gave me something else to go with. And, you know, I just found a map on the internet of a dwarven mine and the mercenary company were for some reason exploring that dwarven mine and they went in after them to try and get them in there.
Yeah, and the background choices, are they random generated in 13th Age? I can't remember that, or is it something the players...
No, they're always... In 13th Age, they're not random. I suppose you could generate them randomly because there are plenty of tables of this stuff around, but no, yeah. They're chosen by the players. So all the backgrounds, you know, the skills, the former jobs, and the one you clean are all chosen by the players. So they're already invested in that. And if you bring that into your campaign, it's an immediate way for the player to connect to what's going on. I mean, I ran a game of 13th Age at Gen Con once. I was doing a demo for Pelgrain. And when I turned up to run the demo, I'd left the scenario behind in the main hall, which was, you know, half a mile away. And I couldn't run back and get it because it would have wasted a whole load of time. So I just looked at the character sheets. I knew it involved blue dragons and something. I looked at the character sheets, looked at their one unique things and their backgrounds, and just went from that. And I bought things in from each of the characters, and you know it was great because they were all immediately invested, because it was something. They put the one unique things on the characters themselves. So when you write when you do pre-gens for 13th Age, you don't do the backgrounds, you don't do the one unique things, you get the players to put them in. You know, it only takes 10 minutes, and they're invested in the character because it's something they've made, even though they haven't rolled any dice or done all their choosing, you know, all the complicated rules-based stuff they haven't had to do, but they've chosen all the narrative stuff. And story is the thing that people connect with. You know, we're always looking for story. When something happens in your life, you don't just tell it in the order the things happened. You explain it in the way a story would. So sometimes you'll use flashbacks, and sometimes you'll, you know, I knew this was going to happen in the future because something that happened in the past. But really, you didn't know. You're just explaining it like that because that makes a better story.
Yeah. And the ability to recognize, the players recognize themselves into the story. They can mirror the characters. They can see, oh, you said the Baron, what the fuck, what the guy said in our background. And suddenly you, Steve, are referring to that this guy, and then suddenly there's a connection between the story and the players, and using that as a bridge between you and the character, the story and the characters are just so great.
Yeah,
and they mirror themselves into the story. That's a good way to make them more into the game for sure.
Definitely.
But when you create these, you are a very skilled improviser for sure. And as you said, and try this a lot. But if you want to let your players be more a part of the story or create the story with you around the table, how would you do this? Example in 13H.
Okay, well, I've got another gumshoe game, which is a fantasy gumshoe game. It's called Dazoon. It's a hack of gumshoe, and it's inspired by sort of Conan and Gérald of Jouarre and sort of 1950s-60s sword and sorcery. At the start of the game, it's got character classes in it, and it's got levels, which is just because one of my players likes levels. And so each character class is a playbook. It's got very cut down gumshoe rules. So in gumshoe, you have about 40 or 50 abilities. In Dazoon, you have 7. But the important thing at the start is you do world building together. So the world is called Dazoon. That's essentially all you know about it. But then each character class... There are five character classes. You can have six character classes. You can only have one from each class. It's a bit like a playbook by the Apocalypse. But one of the things that each character class has to do is define something about the world. And these are very specific things. So if you're a warrior, the two things that you have to define about the world are a war that is currently going on and a new enemy that has arisen. And you can just make, and we have a map as well. And as the player is saying those things, we write them on the map. So if he says there's a war between these two countries, we draw a line down the middle of the map and write the names of the two countries. If he says the new enemy is some kind of guerrilla force, I don't know, we draw a bit of jungle or a forest or something and say there's something going on in there, and we put a name on it. Then somebody has to define a hero of the setting, and usually the hero becomes the patron of the players quite often. You know, it's usually a good king or something like that. And we have to define a villain, and he's usually on the bad side, you know, the opposite side of the hero. So the players are involved doing something in that. The priest has to talk about a new religion that's arisen and an omen. You know, these are massive hooks. The players define all this stuff. And so at the start, as a GM, you end up with 12 facts about the world that you can use straight away to develop a story and something that the players can do. Because a thief, for example, one of the things that he defines is what great treasure has not yet been stolen. So, you know, you can either discuss amongst you which one of these things you want to look at immediately, or you can just let the GM do it, and they'll say, this guy hires you to go and steal this treasure that hasn't yet been stolen.
From this hero guy.
For example.
With the gorilla killer monkeys. Oh, well.
Yeah. And so, you just go so with that
story right there. And the challenge, of course, for GM is to make it put all these elements into a pot and make a great stew. But also make enough ingredients so there will be some mystery for the players as well. But also use a lot of these elements to create a story, because one of my challenges, if I let my players define too much of the setting, for example Fallout, there's a lot of mystery. The meter knowledge the players are linked into, so that they should be linked into, and not have they shouldn't have this knowledge about this area, and that some of the mystery and the aha ability in the story will dissipate. How do you challenge? How do you mix and mix this and balance this?
Well, in the last game of Darzun we played, the omen that was chosen was, if somebody builds higher than the gods, then Darzun will fall. Mm. Essentially, it doesn't define anything except something bad's happened if this other thing happens, but it doesn't really tell you what that thing is. So even though the players know that this omen exists, and everybody in the world technically knows this omen exists, but they don't really know what it means. Yeah. And so you find out in play. And what we found out in play is some bad guys are building a giant pyramid in the desert. Azun comes with a load of information about how to think about the theme. I was looking at this and using there are kind of prompts for the GM basically to decide how the thing is going to happen. And so I decided that this giant pyramid was sending out waves of control. So anybody who got too close to it got sucked in and had to go and build the pyramid. So the players tried to get close to it and find a way of not being mind controlled by the pyramid. And essentially that was coming from, the Illuminati pyramid is a kind of mind control pyramid. And that was my influence for that. So the things the players defined are one line, and they're essentially, they don't give very much meaning. They just define the top level of something, what it is, in very vague terms. And we discover in play how that applies to the players and to the world. But also, I don't mix too many elements at one time. Because if you overdo that, if you involve too many elements, then too much is going on for it to be a proper story. Stories are actually quite tight. There tends to be a main character, and things are happening to that main character. Here, it's a group of characters, but you need continuity in it. You don't want every time they go into a new scene, something completely different happens. A new thing threatens them that's completely unrelated to anything else, because that way there's no continuity in the story, and it's not a proper story anymore. It's just a shark attacks them, then a giant attacks them. We don't know why this is happening. You know, you need reasons. You need a reason for them to go from A to B. And Gumshoe is, the Gumshoe system essentially says, when you're in a location, there will be something that points you to at least one more location. So the clue tells you that there might be something interesting at point B and point C. If you're at point A, go and have a look. And it's an invitation to go and have a look, and it's a reason to go and have a look. It's not just you walk down the road and hit something else with your hammer.
It's a balancing act, of course, because you, as you said, the too many elements will ruin the stew for sure, or the experience for the players, but too few elements will make the player agency and what the players have come up with not important in some sense, and then they will be disappointed, right?
Yeah, so although they've defined 12 things at the start, I probably only used 3 of them in the first session. I might hint at some other ones, I like to hint at some other things going on somewhere else, which the players are not, and it's not affecting them, they're not affecting it, but they hear rumours of stuff going on in far off lands that, it's not saying this thing is a threat to you, but you're aware that this stuff exists in the world, and it's brought to your attention via in-world means. So it's keeping it in the setting without focusing on it to the extent that it's taking up a lot of player time.
If you want to look at your players, not to say any names of your players or anything, but do you have any more wishes for your players that they could use, could help you more create the story or take more responsibility for the narrative?
Some players.
And how to educate your players to do this? Have you any good tools for this?
Well, one of the things you can do is ask questions. So, if there is the omen that anybody who builds higher than the gods will bring around the fall of Dazoon, you can ask one of the players, how does your character know, how was your character's family affected by this in the past? And so it's you're not giving him a yes no question, you're giving him a question where you're inviting him to develop the setting a bit more.
Yeah, and giving some hints into what the players, not the characters, but the player, want to experience in this campaign, try to draw some information out of this player, because it could be cool that for this player that he wants to experience that the pyramid, the mind controlling pyramid, will try to take control of his city or whatever, and try to figure out how to create a game with the players and the campaign ideas with the players, for sure.
And I think this technique is called painting the scene.
Yeah.
It's used quite a lot in games like Trophy and things like that. It's older than that, it was talked about on the Forge, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And possibly on the Usenet before that. I'm not that familiar with what was happening in the 90s, but asking questions where it gives the player an opportunity to provide some interesting details about something that's happening in the world, rather than just saying, was your family involved in this? They could say yes or no. That's not very interesting for anyone. Yeah. So you kind of put them in that situation already, you're telling them your family was involved before, what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And they can, they can make it sad or happy or whatever they like.
Yeah.
Anything they bring in at that point is going to make for interesting play, because you can riff on that. You can either, it starts to repeat itself in the current time, or it's going differently wrong this time. You've got an established fact about the world, and that can be part of the story, but also you've got how it happened in the past, and so you can make it the same or different, and that gives you something to reflect upon, and the player has a straight in there as well, because he knows what's going on now.
Yeah, and the character and his character, or this player's character, can be a key element in the story, or just a sidebar character. For instance, it's not important, because it's the player that creates the game with you as a GM, and he can.
Yeah.
And some players can even be so bold or so great players that they actually create a character that will die in part of the few first sessions, because it's part of that bigger narrative that he wants to establish with the other players, and not telling the other players, of course, but maybe tell you as a GM, so you can leverage a lot of his on his death in session 4 or 5 or something like that, so he can be give a jump into the next part of the story. So that's some great things that if players take this semi GM role, and that's one of the key elements in this talk with you, is how to let the players be more part of the game and be more willing to take chances and be part of the narrative.
Yeah, I mean, in some games you can go even further than that, and just so we played a game of Mortal Coil, which is usually a GM'd game.
Mm-hmm.
The setting in Mortal Coil, you make your own setting. So our setting was. It was all the characters were Neanderthals at the time of the rise of the Cro-Magnons. And the problem with Neanderthals is they had magical powers, of some kind to do with animals and the land mostly, and the Cro-Magnons didn't. But the Neanderthals couldn't lie, and the Cro-Magnons could. And this was providing a lot of friction between the two of them, and the Cro-Magnons were breeding faster and overtaking things. But the way we shared the gem rule was that every player defined a big bad, essentially some kind of big threat to the world. So mine was an enormous bear that was just running around eating things.
Yeah.
And somebody else had about a volcano.
Mm-hmm.
And there was stuff we could do about these, but any time that the person, any time the bear was the main part of the story, I would run that bit. Mm-hmm. And any time it was the volcano, the guy who'd invented the volcano, he ran that mm-hmm. bit. And we just took it in turns, whoever had chosen that kind of threat to the group of Neanderthals.
Yeah.
Every time that threat was being highlighted, the player who invented it was running that.
Yeah. And then you rotate player characters, and your character will be less visible in the scenes, or how did you do
this? There'll be an NPC, but they wouldn't have much to do.
But that's because that's some of the challenges. I have a strong group in my Fallout group campaign, and this and try to write it down as a sellable campaign, or at least free of charge on the internet somewhere. And some of my challenges is that I have a strong player group, but I'm not sure that my player group another player group can pick up that pace or that's ability to play the game as we have played it, because some play groups haven't got this talent that be a GM-ish as a player. But we can jump in that later, because that's one of our talking points later in this talk. That's some of my wishes, that my players will take more narrative control and not to subvert the story anyway, or overrule other players' experience or anything, but make more help the group paint a painting, as you said, paint the scenes for the other players.
Yeah.
One of my favorite actual play podcasts are Rigmarole Role Playing, and there's an American that plays with him sometimes, and I'm adores him. I can't remember his name, I'm sorry, but he plays he have this is like he takes narrative control in the scenes as a player and go into describe how he goes to the table and how to pick up the whiskey on the table and pours it and smells on it. But the GM hasn't established that there are a table or a whiskey or it's how it smells. That's totally his control and how to paint a picture with the players and have these great players, and that's my wish for my players for sure. Listen out there to take more narrative control of games or scenes in some regards, right?
I think it's sometimes difficult for players because they don't want to overstep their place to a certain extent. Yeah. They don't want to spoil the game by saying something that other people don't agree with. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a fine line to be drawn between stuff that influences your character, which is fine, mm-hmm. and stuff which pushes other characters in a certain direction, which is less fine.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
And as long as you're just doing stuff for your own character, usually it's fine. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some games, I think, like Polaris, which is also, you know, about 15 to 20 years old now, where whenever one player did something and somebody else didn't like it, it didn't fit in with their view of how the game went, you could just say, could you try that another way, please?
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I'm not disagreeing with the thing that you said.
Oh.
Completely, but the way you did it isn't quite fitting with the theme that I thought we had for this game. And a lot of games have that kind of rule in where you can ask somebody to try it again. A lot of the time it's GMs who have in Dazoon, the GM has control of the theme of the game. So the players can define facts in the game, but the GM's job is to try and keep them on the theme that the GM sees the overall game has got.
Yeah, so that's like if you if you have a player that wants to have a starship in the soon campaign setting, that's not the theme we are playing. We are playing Swords and Sorcery.
Yeah.
So that's not available. Just stop doing that. And if you have players that are grown-ups and are into the game, that will not happen. But it could happen because they are defining the facts. It's a fine balance to let your players let loose and, of course, trust your players, not only because you as a GM you can meddle with the game as you want and subvert some of the players' choices if they are too far out, but the other players might be more challenged to get back on track, and that's my worry about letting players into too much control of the narrative. It's ruined the other players' fun. So help the players put in a framework so the players are not ruining each other's fun, for sure.
So Mortal Coil has a theme document that you define at the start, which tells you pretty much what the theme of the game is and says it's about these things and it's explicitly not about these things. Mm-hmm. And that helps players get a better angle on what kind of things are seen as acceptable and what kind of things are not acceptable.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not they're not acceptable, they just don't fit in with this game. So, you know, try and fit in with the game a bit. The thing that we agreed with at the start, so you agreed with this, so can you please stick to what you agreed to?
For sure.
And I think the players who I've had who are started playing that kind of game generally are quite happy to make, you know, changes to what they say to make sure that it fits with the thing they've agreed with.
Yeah.
And I think Session Zero is massively useful
oh, yes.
for this.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
There are some games where I wish I had had a Session Zero before it was a thing, because we didn't kind of define. There was a game of Dreamlands called Cthulhu. Well, it was Trail of Cthulhu, mm-hmm. Dreamhounds of Paris, and that essentially one of the players thought it was a bit like D&D.
Mm-hmm.
And that just killed the game, which was sad.
Yeah, that's because it's a great game. When you want to write these things down as a game designer or a campaign writer, as you have created the Theophil Symmetries, how can you
yeah.
help players picking up these? You talked on before we were recording that you just heard an actual play podcast with Theophil Symmetries, so that would be pretty weird for you and listen to some other guy pick up your game and run it for you or run it so you can listen into it, not even as a player. So how can we define some frameworks so can help GMs helping players to be a better narrative former? How can this be written down in some capacity? Can you formulate anything like that?
Yeah, so this was Age of Ravens, and yeah. the guys running it is Lowell Francis.
Yeah.
And at the end of the session in particular, there were two really great things that they did.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody had to give stars and wishes.
Yeah.
So stars is when you say what you liked about what the other players in the GM did
yeah.
in the session.
Yeah.
And it's when you liked what their characters did, when they were developing bits of narrative that you liked, when they generated attention that you liked,
mm-hmm.
The way they said something, just anything that you really appreciated,
yeah.
And that you thought brought depth and interest to the campaign. And the other thing was wishes, which is directions you want the story to go in,
mm-hmm.
you know, things that are in the background that you want to explore a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not saying, I want this to happen, but there's that thing over there, you know, the Rollwright stones. I want to understand what their part in the story is, and can we explore that
mm-hmm.
a bit more? And the contract there isn't that the GM will do everything in the next session. The
no.
contract is we're running a campaign.
Yeah.
At some point, that will happen.
Yeah, and the stars and wishes are so great. I'm using them like second, like each or other. Session I'm running with my groups, and if it's Vesen or Dune or Fallout or whatever,
yeah.
And the great thing with wishes, especially, is that is also wishes from a player to another player, that they know if we have the table together, Steve, and the players, the two of us, our characters are not connecting in some way. So I can make a wish that can we connect with each other in some way, make a conflict or make a love session or make something worthwhile exploring between the characters, the two characters of us, and then it will create a new narrative and a new scenes in the future sessions in sometimes, and maybe the players, as you said, it's a campaign, so it's not the next session or the next session again, but it's like session 10 or 12 from now, and the GM can help setting up this this wish that we can be trapped back to back in a tunnel with zombies around us, and we can have this connection of we have survived this terrible event. So that's also a thing I like to use, that the players also can connect to each other with these wishes, and of, as you said, the stars as well, as you can say, okay, that was pretty cool, Steve, that you make this the jump from the bridge and shot the bad guy in the head and fall down and broke your shoulder, so I can save you or fix your dislocated shoulder or whatever. That was pretty cool scene. So that's also a way to challenge and lift up the other players and lift up the campaign as a whole. It's a good tool and especially one I want to explore more in this in a future episode for sure. That's the way they did it on the Actual Play podcast. How did you when you wrote Fearful Symmetries, how did you figure out to make the players more into the narrative, and how much did the players define in this this huge campaign?
So it starts with a setting. It starts with an initial scene, and the setup is the same for every group. It's like a mini scenario. Something terrible happens, and then you've got some clues pointing to different things that you might explore. And the campaign doesn't really define much about how you explore these things or what's going to happen. It has locations, and it has things at those locations, and it has NPCs. And they are written up, particularly the NPCs. Each NPC is written up in three different ways, as a positive NPC, as a negative NPC, or as a neutral NPC.
Yeah.
So when as a GM you're running it, when the players go and investigate and talk to an NPC, you can decide, you know, are they being helpful to the player characters, or are they being seemingly helpful to the player characters, but they're only doing it so they can get in with them to do this horrible thing later on. And so that's one way in which essentially I don't write down what's going to happen next. I set up scenes where things might happen, but I don't decide up front what the outcome is. And all that a scene needs to do is have something interesting happen and point at some other scene. So a scene needs an in and an out, and it needs something interesting to happen. Now, the interesting thing can be a piece of information, or it can be an argument with somebody. It could be a fight. Mm-hmm. I mean, fights don't happen very often in Trail of Cthulhu.
Nope. Not interesting.
Well, some of them are, but it's not the most common kind of scene.
Oh.
And also, my characters are all magicians, so there's quite a lot of scenes when they're doing magic.
Yeah.
But essentially, magic is trying to do one of these other things by other means, essentially.
Yeah, and that's I'm pretty curious about it, because the Fearful Symmetry is that the precursor is that all the players recognize that there are wizards like Harry Potter. it's more the mages or magic users or what do you call
them.
And suddenly this will be revealed on them in the start of the campaign. But how much do the players define this, and how much do you help them define that reality around the players?
So there is a session zero sort of written up for Fearful Symmetries now, where you talk about the magical group to which they belong, about the rules of the magical group. There's also how powerful do you want the magic to be. So there's quite a lot of stuff at the start where you decide how the magical group is going to operate as a group. And how it relates to other magical groups as well, to a certain extent. I mean, you don't know any other magical groups, but you define some rules about how magical groups operate with each other. So you have some idea at the start, as a player, how this is going to work. Your character doesn't necessarily know, but most people can deal with the dichotomy fine. And that way, one of the things I do a lot is, you know, what are you interested in exploring now? And then I listen to what the players say. And not only do I listen to what they say to me, but quite a lot of the time they talk to each other about what's going on.
Yeah.
And they generate an enormous number of hypotheses and theories about what's happening in the world.
Yeah.
And it's quite easy to pick one of them. Or it's quite easy to pick one of them and either decide that that is what's going on, mm-hmm. or decide that that is expressly not what's going on, but it's what they think is going on.
Especially.
Or a mix of the two. Essentially, it can't be anything else. Either that is happening or it isn't, or part of that is happening.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are the only things that can happen in the world. There's mystery there. The players don't know what's happening. I don't know what's happening at the point where they're discussing it either. But then their actions, you know, depending on what they do next, that defines to a certain extent what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I do that by looking at how much information they're given. So every time they find out a new bit of information about the world, I decide whether it's true or not. And I decide, you know, I don't decide immediately whether it's true, but if they act on it, they will soon find out whether it's true or not. And that builds up a rich picture of how the world is functioning. And slowly they develop a theory of what's going on and they explore more, and some of it's true and some of it's false. And that crystallizes what is actually true, because essentially if they find out enough information, there can only be one way that's true usually.
Yeah.
And so that's what becomes true in the game, and that's what they find out is going on, and that's what they have to deal with. One of the things I like to have in the thing that turns out to be true is some kind of moral dilemma for them.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's fine finding out that, you know, there's an ogre under the bridge and he's eating everybody. That's, you know, okay, we'll go and deal with the ogre. But then you find out that the ogre actually is the spirit of the bridge, and if you kill the ogre, then the bridge will fall down. And everybody uses the bridge all the time to get over the ravine, and if you destroy the bridge, you're going to get the food over the ravine. So what are you going to do? So it's much better to have that moral choice where there's no right answer, because the players have to make an actual decision there about what they're going to do, and they're going to change the world as well. You know, killing the ogre will just, if it didn't affect the bridge, killing the ogre is a bit of a boring outcome, because you've just got a dead ogre, and then what are we going to kill next? But if the bridge is dependent on the ogre, and the villagers are dependent on the bridge, you've got a much harder decision. You've got to think much more creatively. And players come up with some amazing plans, you know, stuff that you would never think of. Because there's four or five of them, usually, and there's one of you, and you can take time plotting it out in a Sherlock Holmes or Agatha Christie kind of way. But in my experience, these things are much harder to play because you have to control the information much more tightly.
Yeah, and if you control it too tightly, the players might be missing interest in the agency or the ability to make agency, especially in a long campaign that with if they have to connect to a character. In so many sessions, you have to let them have this agency to create the story with you, or the most experienced players will be bored out of their ass if you put too many trials, rules on top of their heads, for sure.
And in fact, that's not how Sherlock Holmes works, because Sherlock Holmes, when you listen to what he's talking about in the TV or read the book, you know, he goes through an enormous number of ways the thing could have happened, and he chooses the one way it did happen. All the others are probably perfectly valid theories as well. It's just that he always chooses the one that it turns out to be at the end. And it's a bit like that, really. The players choose the one that it turns out to be at the end. But they don't do it in one decision. It takes, you know, it takes a while for them to find out exactly. So in the current, you know, in my current game, there's a ritual going along on a river that they think is bad. They've gone to the end of the river, where the river joins the Thames, and they've done a bit of exploration. They've found out some stuff. They have no idea what's going on. I don't really know what's going on. I know it's bad. But as they explore more and they dig things up and they talk to people, they find out more stuff, and it builds a richer picture, and it's starting to congeal in my mind what's going on, and it's starting to congeal in their mind at the same time about what's going on. And the lovely thing for me is that there's a mystery there, and I don't know what the answer is, and they don't know what the answer is, but we'll find out together. And that's, you know, as a GM, that's what's exciting for me is exploring. And it's, in some ways, you're a bit like a player. I mean, you've got a different role in the game, but you're playing to find out.
Yes.
All the time. Mm-hmm. And that's just lovely.
That's pretty cool, yeah. Do players, could they take too many agencies? We talked about it briefly just in a moment. About taking the agency too far and making the players, the other players uncomfortable, or making ruin the other player's game. How can you help GMs to leverage this so that it's a net positive that they are agents, they use a lot of agency into the campaign, but also how can we balance this so we don't ruin games for the other players?
Well, we've talked about some of the things already. So session zero, about defining theme, and also defining veto as well. So, you know, if there's a GM, one of their roles, to, in my view, is that they have veto over some stuff that might happen in the game. I mean, you already define these things for safety. So in your session zero, you'll talk about lines and veils, and you'll talk about the X card. And, you know, this is stuff we don't want because it's making people unhappy and unsettling and triggering and things they don't want in their game. You know, I don't have any sexual violence in my game. We don't have any spiders. Because one of the players is severely arachnophobic, and so we just don't have any of that. But you can do that thing for story elements as well. You know, the X card doesn't have to just apply to unsettling things. It can apply to things that are not taking the story in a way that the majority of people want. And it is a cooperative game, role-playing. It's not the GM against the players. I mean, it was in Gary Gygax's day. It's how many PCs can you kill in the first room?
Yeah.
But these days, this is the person who's trying to facilitate the enjoyment of everybody. And so tell people that at the start, because I think most players understand that now, but not everybody has been brought up in that way of playing. You know, if you've just been playing Redbox D&D and essentially you're going into a thing and killing everything and taking their treasure, then, you know, you haven't come across the be generous and try and bring other players into it and express your character in ways other than how many hit points damage they do per round.
Yeah. And that's trying to, as we talked about before, to sacrifice your own character to bring forth a great narrative and so on. Alien RPG is a great way to make this game to sacrifice your own players own character in the great altar of the great story, like Vasquez in Aliens 2, where she blows up herself in the air duct. Instead of trying to normal players or normal D&D Redbox players, if we can classify those kind of players, they will try to run from the monster and try to get up beside the other players. But in modern players or great players as we play with this, they will play Vasquez as she does in the Alien movie, right? To blow herself up, so the other players can move on and not be eaten by the aliens. That's pretty cool to have these kind of players around the table. And aliens do it very, very well because there's a a fluctuation of characters. There's a lot of characters for the players, so that's another way to play for sure, but another time for another story. When we look at games, as we talked on the 13 Age, as you said, the background can help you build into this campaign. I run a short Dune campaign where the players create their player group and the house and the rival house and so on. The GM hasn't any saying in these, and the players are not creating characters. They actually create a house, and then we fill out the house members in the as characters as we run scenes. There's not a specific character for each player for as such, but often the players will take on, because it's so integrated into to character players that they will not let go of a character and play another character and so on, and rotate the characters between them as such. But Dune does it very well to try to figure out how to play a game in a different way.
Yeah.
You run a invasion campaign in the Britain, the Great Britain book, the Mythos of the Great Book, what it's called.
Mythic Britain and Ireland.
Yeah, the newest edition. Yeah, the newest edition. And of course, as you live on the island of Great Britain, yeah, it's a gorgeous book. You of course can use a lot of your background in folklore on the islands and so on, but your players should also use some of that, their background, if they are also from England or for Wales or whatever. How do you create a, let's talk Vesen, because Vesen is more and more popular, luckily, because it's a great system and a great way to tell stories. But also they have this downtime system where the players actually take narrative control of the decisions. They build up their headquarters and they get some points that they can figure out how to use in some way. How do you involve your players in your Vesen campaign?
So we've done two mysteries so far. And so they have, is it two or three? I can't remember. Three, I think, actually. So they have, we've done the between stuff, and they've built up their headquarters. It's slightly different. They are, so when they're talking about their headquarters, they're slightly in character, but not completely in character, because they're looking up things in the book and working out how many points things cost. So it's a kind of a mix of the two, but they've got some new staff and they've given them names. And essentially, that's the thing they do between them. I pointed out that this is what they could do, and I told them how many points they've got. And so they just chose between them what they were going to introduce. But Vesen, it has a bit of effect on the future mysteries, because, you know, they've got an inventor now, so... he can create a thing that they can use during the next adventure. And I can't remember what they're saving up for next, but also the other thing they do, Vesen, is at the start, you have a scene with the player characters where they get something which will help them in the adventure. And they define what that is. And, they essentially, they frame a scene for you, and you can either play that in character, where their character is talking to somebody, getting a book or finding out some information, or you can or they can just tell you what happened, but that gives them a bit more control over defining what's going to happen in the next session, and also gives them a starring role in the scene, essentially, because they're the only player character in it usually. And so that's quite fun, I think. I don't think it's quite subtle, I think, is the other thing. It's not, you're not hard framing them in a scene, and you're not asking them to paint the scene with quite a pointed question. You're giving them the opportunity to explore some facet of their character, that everybody else can hear as well. So other players will pick up on stuff that's said during this scene as well, which is quite nice.
Yeah. And these scenes, the advantages that they will put up, it's like mechanical. It's a mechanical thing that we can they can use into the mystery, and help. And you can of course set the mystery after what the advantage is into the mystery and make it harder or easier for the players and they can you can use they get some extra dice when they use this ability or disadvantage they have set up. So that's one way to use agency for players, that they can tell a story with you and have a mechanical or a system buffer buff in their character sheets. That's pretty cool. And it's a reward for players that are maybe not very narrative strong or don't want to take control of a narrative, as we talked on before, that wouldn't overstep you as a GM or overstep the other players. But in this element, you have to overstep and you have to take control, and you, because not only you are building up a scene or a narrative, but you also get a bonus, a very hardcore bonus, a system might cost. That's also reward into the players. So that's one way to do it. I think Vesen does it very well. Also, the, as you said, the downtime thing and the elements about building up this advantage before the mystery are pretty cool.
I have a thing in Darzoon where at the beginning of the game you define your character's drive. At any point during the game where you say you're using your drive, you get +2 to your roll, which is not a massive bonus, but it's quite a nice bonus. And all you have to do is say, this is how my drive is helping. You just explain in a short scene about how your drive is helping you be more competent in the current scene. And so it does a similar thing. It encourages people to discuss their character and they get a narrative. They get a mechanical bonus. The mechanics give them a bonus. And small bonuses, you know, that's gamification, essentially. humans like getting small and infrequent bonuses for stuff. And it encourages them to seek more of these small and infrequent bonuses. So you're training them to be more narrative.
And the invasion and again the advantages. I love the when the players are. If you have an officer in the group, he will take on his sword and shine it up and make a scene out in the carriage out to from the headquarters to the mystery area, the village or whatever, and he will narrative. Tell how he shines up his sword and make sure his pistol is clean and so on. So make these painting these pictures for the other players as we talked on just before. And helping setting the mood and building up this, giving us these images of the 18th century and figuring out how to get into the mood of Vesen and this time of history and what is important and so on. So that's so key for me.
One of the things I like to see with players, which I'm not quite sure how to encourage it yet, is so you get players who are really good at playing their own character and, you know, do a lot of really good description and are very involved in the game. And then you get players who are good at these things as well. But what they do is they invite other players to shine as well. So, you know, the fighter might be great at fighting and he's describing how the fight's going, but then he's going to leave an opening for the cleric to do something. You know, he's falling back because he's injured. And he's not saying can you heal me? He's describing it. He's giving the other player an in the narrative to come in and do something. And that kind of generosity of play really makes for a dynamic group, because it's a bit like one of those mirror balls you get in a disco. It doesn't it doesn't just it reflects the light everywhere. You know, if you're the player who's reflecting the play everywhere and giving other players opportunities to play, you're generating so much more play in the game and involvement and narrative that it makes it a much mm-hmm. richer environment to play in.
And it's funny with the Division games because the mystery is like it's much like the Monster of the Week kind of mystery, and it's very tight when the players lands into the mystery. It's very GM controlled in many ways. There's a lot of handouts, or there's a tight mystery that the players have to figure out in a certain way to link up this mystery. But then we withdraw out of the mystery, and they have solved the mystery, or they have died, or whatever, the monster got away, or whatever. And then we draw away, and then the players take over narrative control, and then it's a great back and forth in Jason, I think, for most cases. So that's pretty cool, and that balance is so much key for me when I'm running this game. The Fallout game, have you played the Fallout game?
I've not played Fallout, no.
Do you know the video game?
Yeah, I played the video game.
Yeah. And in that game, they actually in the pre-written scenario in the game book, they want you to, as a group to find what the village or the settlement, the community, the players are living in, what they do, what resources there are, what kind of raid-up gangs there are close by, what kind of monsters there is close by, what kind of environment, and so on. So the GM, as such, doesn't have any say in this and try to figure out how to create the whole this game, like in the game you talked about where the players defines two things each other up to 12 things if you have a full group of six, right? So that's pretty cool, and making the players be more part of the campaign, it's something I will explore a lot more in my future GMing and campaign building for sure. We have touched on the last part of our outline, Steve, and about the other games and the mechanics, and you would of course the Zune game and 13H and so on. So that's pretty cool to round out that part of it. But I have in the last part of this talk with you, Steve, I have three secret questions for you. They're just yes no questions, and then we can unfold one of those for sure.
Okay.
If you're up to it.
Yep.
the new Wizards of the Coast OGL drama, is that a net positive for other games?
No.
The new AI art, is that a net positive for role playing games?
No.
No. Okay. Yeah. How is the post pandemic? Is that a net positive for role playing games? We play more online in the pandemic. Is that a net positive for role playing games as such?
Yes.
Yes, that's for sure. Yeah, let's talk about the AI, because that's you were a pretty unsure of. How do you feel about this? I know some of those you're working with, like Ken and Robin, they are pretty harsh on it on his podcast, on their podcast for sure. And
you say that, but Robin does a lot of AI art.
Yeah. But Ken are not fond of it for sure. he's yelling a lot of it. But yeah, and I'm creating a game called Spiral, which come out soon. Later this year. it's a single scenarios concept where we took a choice that AI art is the way we have to do if we want anything that looks pretty, and then if we have a success with it, we will bring on real artists. That's our model for now.
Yep.
And that's what the choice I made with my colleague Lars, and it's just the way it is. I would love to have two or three different artists creating the character and the sceneries and so on, but I didn't have $3,000 for the art alone. So that was a choice we made. And if players don't want to use our product because of that, it's too bad for us, but that was the choice we made. So what are you feeling about this?
Well, that is very much the dichotomy I'm seeing. So Chaosium, for example, have said they're not going to use any AI art, which is fine for Chaosium, because as far as role-playing games, they're one of the... I mean, they're a medium-sized company, which means they're enormous in role-playing. They've got artists.
Yeah.
They can afford to pay artists up front to do art. Mm-hmm. But most of the role-playing products we see are not from Chaosium. I mean, they produce a lot, but look at the enormous amount of product coming out of itch.io and all the zines that are being published now. I mean, there's an amazing amount of art that people are doing, and a lot of that is people doing art for their own games. So if you're not an artist, it becomes quite difficult, because art is expensive, as you say. You know, you haven't got however much thousands it costs to make art for your game. So using AI to get I'm not a decent artist at all.
Nope.
And so if I was writing a game, you need art, because you know, games without art don't do half as well. Mm. But if you're no good at art and you can't afford an artist, then AI will at least give you a leg up and be a placeholder. As you say, mm-hmm. you know, if this game does well and people want to buy it, we'll pay an artist to do it. And that, I think it depends who you are as to whether it's... I don't think it's a yes-no answer, because I agree with Chaosium, you know, they're at the top of the tree, and they're nowhere near Hasbro, obviously, but they're doing the right thing essentially for them, which is to use proper artists, because they can afford it, they've got it all set up, and it's not going to damage their business by carrying on using artists, I don't think.
No,
but for small publishers, it's very difficult.
Yeah, it is. And that was the choice we made. So I think it's a great discussion, and in some future years or so on, there will be artists that are specialized into taking on AI art and convert it into real art and like modified it. So that would be it will be fun to see how to jingle with this for sure.
Well, it can just be used as art direction, you know. We want something that looks a bit like this.
Yeah, and then you can draw it for me, or I will show a picture of what this kind of monster. But I want the monster turned this way instead, and I can't figure out how to.
I want proper hands on it.
Art one. Yeah. For example, that's a difficulty for the machine.
Although,
right now, so,
you know, by next year they'll have sorted out the hands problem, because they'll be focusing on it. So.
Yeah.
Just get better. I mean, the other issue with the art is, where are they getting the data from?
Yeah. And that's other difficulty, because if they are stealing, straight up stealing, it's a problem. But
well, it's slightly more complicated than straight up stealing, because any artist who draws is looking at other people's art.
Yeah, it's one of the key arguments for this, because. It's for sure. If I want to, I can also draw, but I also look at other arts and see. Okay, I want to have this kind of monster or this kind of a door or whatever, and what kind of art line I want to explore. It's so teaching myself how to draw is pretty difficult to not be inspired by others, but when this machine gets inspired by hundreds of artists in the same in a second and generates a picture for you in a, under a minute. It I can see why artists are getting frustrated and not happy about this evolution.
Well,
for sure.
You know, nobody's getting paid for supplying their stuff. You know, if an artist has seen something published, somebody has bought that. Mm-hmm. They've already made money out of it, hopefully. So they're drawing inspiration from something that's already been monetized, whereas a lot of the stuff that's going to the AI thing, I don't know if it's been monetized already. So it's taking
It's hard to say.
It's taking money away from artists.
Yeah, for sure. And if you want to publish something in AI art, I think it's important that you inform your consumers that this is the business model we have chosen.
Yeah.
And be clear and be frank about it for sure. That's things are very important.
Yeah, I think there might be some legal involvement at some point. It hasn't got to that yet, but I'm sure somebody's going to take umbrage and there's going to be a court case, probably in America, and that's going to settle the legal point of view.
For sure.
And I imagine that they'll just say AI art is okay.
Yeah, maybe. It's because AI art, it's
unless you're copying Disney, in which case it's not.
Yeah. So then they will hit you on the face with a hammer for sure. that's for sure. But when you but also there's a text AI as well that's creating scenarios. The two of us are creating scenarios, and so I will look at this and say, wow, that's pretty cool, and I will maybe write in some words and so get some inspiration if there is a scene, if there is a city or a character that I have difficulty to formulate for in words, then use this tool to get some inspiration.
Yeah, I've done that.
So that's and that's it's pretty cool. And I've seen a entire Warhammer RPG one shot scenario written in this machine.
Yeah,
so it's pretty cool.
You do need to work on your prompts because it comes out fairly bland if you just say write me an adventure that includes a ranger, a druid, and a magician. It will come up with something very bland. But the more weird prompts that you put in, the better it, and also you can tell it to you. There are sliders where you can control how much the original premise it's going to include and how much it's going to go off on a tangent. And the ones that go off on a tangent are usually better. I mean, essentially, you know, procedural generation of maps we've already got. For my 13th Age campaign, I used two randomly generated maps, and then I went back and put all the interesting stuff on the map. It was just the landscape essentially, and I put the creatures and all that stuff in. But if you're playing an online computer game and you can procedurally generate an adventure, then you know essentially you can keep going forever because you don't need somebody to write it for you. And I think that is going to happen essentially.
Yeah.
Also, you can allow the user to write prompts for it so that the adventure that is generated is something that matches what they want.
Mm-hmm. And that's going to be a difficulty for the two of us, for example, if you want to have anything original for the future. And these prompts will be easier to use for players and or content creators or what we call them. And that's... it's a great dilemma and a difficulty topic for sure, because it will hurt somebody and make somebody else happy.
It's kind of like the view in the 50s where we thought that having robots and machines would give us more time to, or less time.
Yeah.
I'm kind of hoping that will happen, that all the menial jobs will be completely taken up by robots and, you know, AIs, and we can just but we're finding at the moment that isn't quite the case. Some people who have essentially they're hoarding the free time of everybody else by having billions of pounds.
Yeah, for sure. That would be great. Well, Steve, what's next for you in role playing games?
More of the same, I think. I'm currently just running campaigns at the moment, and really enjoying it. I've been trying to write a bit more sort of background material for 13th for Fearful Symmetries, because you know my campaign's been going for almost 7 years, so I've got a ton of material that was never published. But I'm finding writing very difficult at the moment because I've got fatigue, and writing is a much more disciplined and requires much more effort for me than running a game does.
For sure, yeah. But yeah, thanks for this, Steve. It was great talking to you again, and I hope you will pick up the phone again if I.
Oh yeah, definitely.
it's been so much fun and a great inspiration. I hope I will dive into Fearful Symmetry in some future time, because it seems like a vast universe you have created for those poor wizards, and try to figure out how to run that game could be fun to figure that out for sure. So thanks for this, Steve, and
thanks very much.
Sure. Thanks.
Cheers. Bye. Bye-bye.
Thanks to Steve to talk to us about this play agency and campaign. Next week we want to touch on our Spiral game with Lars, and of course our launch of our scenario Jungle Thief and the Spiral game. Follow us on Facebook, GM Workshop, the podcast. If you want to interact with us and talk to us, give us a message.